Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. And from Tallahassee Regional Airport, offering service through American Airlines with daily direct flights from Tallahassee to Miami and Dallas-Fort Worth, with connections to over 270 domestic and international destinations. Fares and information available online at aa.com. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Would more trained and qualified grown-ups with guns make Florida schools safer places for kids, or could it lead to a hail of lawsuits?
Because if there is something that goes wrong, or there is something that happens, it's going to end up in our lap, and we're going to have to litigate that.
Also tonight, as harsher sex offender laws head to the governor's desk, Florida sheriffs say the changes help patch holes in the current system.
He can answer the door, have a little girl tied up in the back bedroom. We'd never know. We can't go look.
We'll also delve into lawsuit reform, wage theft, and digital learning. I'm Tom Flanagan. It's the 2014 Florida lawmaking session, and this is Capitol Report. A divided Florida House committee has given its approval to a measure which could put more guns in schools. It's similar to proposals that have been considered, and in most cases rejected, in other states. But as Stan Jastrzebski reports, the military veteran who proposed it hopes a change he's made to the formula will help it pass.
Among the factors that helped doom similar bills in other states, including a failed measure in Indiana just last year, was a worry that though teachers and principals could be armed, they might not have access to the proper training, or that paying for such training would be too onerous a burden for financially strapped districts. Sarasota Republican Rep. Greg Stube thinks he knows how to fix that. Stube's an Army veteran who served in Operation Iraqi Freedom. Before being deployed, he received weapons and combat training, training he'd like fellow veterans and law enforcement officers to leverage on schools' behalf. His bill allows school districts to hire current or former soldiers and law enforcement officers to serve as school safety officers. And Stube says he'd like to see schools train kids differently, too, perhaps by repurposing time spent yearly on fire drills.
How many children have died in our schools by an active shooter walking in the door and shooting our children? Way too many more than ever should have to. Do we have drills for active shooter type situations required in the state of Florida for our schools? No, we do not.
A chorus of Stube's fellow Republicans hailed the bill as a chance to prevent a school shooting similar to Sandy Hook or Columbine.
We have a problem that inadvertently occurred in our overwhelming desire to protect students with gun-free zones. We have created a sterile target.
I think that a gun-free safe zone is an oxymoron. It's basically saying we don't have guns here, come wreak havoc.
In folklore, everybody left their guns at the city limits. This isn't folklore, this is cold, hard reality.
Those were Representatives Dennis Baxley, Dane Eagle, and Elizabeth Porter. But four of the five Democrats on the House K-12 subcommittee hoped to shoot down the bill. Maitland Rep. Karen Castor-Dental worries teachers are already overburdened.
And when you add additional responsibility for keeping the school safe with teachers and faculty, I think that presents a problem.
And Florida School Boards Association Executive Director Wayne Blanton said he couldn't support the bill in its current form because adding guns to schools might also add legal risk.
A principal may have made a choice that is right or wrong, but we still get litigated. And as a former school board member, you understand where that ends up. It ends up at the local school board level and superintendent's level that you have to defend that litigation.
But Baxley, who's not a lawyer, contends Blanton actually isn't concerned enough about his liability.
I agree. You are ultimately liable. You're also liable. So wonder him got sued by some parent that said, my child is in danger because you won't act.
Since the Sandy Hook shooting, the group Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America has protested allowing more guns into schools for any reason and was instrumental in lobbying Indiana lawmakers to back off their plans to arm educators. A spokeswoman declined comment Wednesday on the Florida proposal, which passed the committee 9-4, mostly along party lines. A similar bill passed the committee but ultimately failed last year. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Stan Jastrzebski.
Bills aimed at keeping sexual predators away from children are headed toward Florida Governor Rick Scott's desk after passing the House today. As Jessica Palumbo reports, law enforcement officers helped craft the laws they say should keep prior offenders from falling through the cracks to prey on kids again.
Last summer, the city of Jacksonville was in mourning after the abduction, assault, and murder of 8-year-old Cherish Periwinkle. Florida Public Radio's Karen Fagans was at the girl's memorial service.
As the prayer service moved outside, three of Cherish's Sunday school friends led those gathered in song, as the young girl's family, her mother, stepfather, and two sisters sat nearby wearing shirts with a giant photograph of Cherish on the front.
Donald Smith, the man convicted of killing Periwinkle, was a registered sex offender. Coincidentally, Duval County Sheriff John Rutherford says on the same day Smith took the girl from a Walmart, police officers had checked his house to verify he lived at his registered address.
But because he was not under any kind of community supervision, we couldn't go into his house. We couldn't go in the house. We couldn't look in his computer to see if he was doing anything wrong. We couldn't look in his house to see if he was contemplating doing something wrong. And had we been able to, it might not have made any difference. But I sure would have loved to have had that opportunity.
That's why Rutherford says one of his favorite changes this year's bills make is requiring community monitoring of sex predators to be carried out after they're released from mental health facilities. Currently, their community monitoring clock starts ticking as soon as they leave prison and go to such a facility, meaning by the time they're released into society, they can be free from unwarranted searches. Another change Rutherford applauds is allowing offenders convicted of lesser crimes to be recommended for mental health treatment. He says Smith had served time for a misdemeanor, even though he'd attempted to abduct another little girl.
If you look at what he was actually convicted of, that was one thing. But if you look at what he had originally been charged with and the behavior that he was exhibiting in the attempted abduction, then you see that he rises to a much more serious level of concern.
If Governor Rick Scott signs the bills, state attorneys and law enforcement will be able to recommend offenders for mental health commitment based on the circumstances surrounding their crimes. Rutherford says he also likes a new requirement ordering offenders to report which county they're moving to when they leave prison. That county's sheriff will receive a notification. If the offender fails to check in within 48 hours, the sheriff can issue a warrant for his arrest. Rutherford says it's a great improvement over the current system.
You know, when they tell DOC, I'm gonna go report to Duval County, but then they don't. Well, I don't even know they're coming.
Also included in the bills are 50-year prison sentences for raping the elderly, disabled, or children under age 12, as well as more reporting requirements about offenders' whereabouts. And sex predators won't be allowed to own or view pornographic material. But some still criticize the bills for emphasizing punishment but not doing enough to prevent sex crimes in the first place.
Well, I ask you this question. Has it worked so far?
Gail Coletta runs the Florida Action Network, a group advocating for what she calls evidence-based sex offender policies.
We have more people in our prisons than ever before, and our sentences are harsher than ever before.
She says as soon as they're convicted, offenders should be evaluated for future risk to see who can be rehabilitated and who can't.
We are individuals. We need to be treated as such. We need to be managed as such. We need to be dealt with as individuals.
One of the bill's sponsors, House Criminal Justice Committee Chair Matt Gaetz, addressed that criticism Wednesday during floor debate.
People could argue about recidivism data till they were blue in the face, but we know one certain fact. No one has ever raped a child while sitting in a state prison.
If Governor Scott signs the bills, it won't be the first time since he's taken office the state tightened controls on sex offenders. He's also signed off on increased penalties for possessing child pornography and not reporting child abuse. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jessica Palumbo.
A bill filed at the Capitol this year would mandate the teaching of the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights in Florida public schools. The declaration lists 30 rights that the bill's supporters say everyone should have. Among them, the right to be born free and equal, regardless of race or gender, and to have access to modern health care. Bill sponsor Dwight Bullard says it's important for kids to know what rights they have and adds some human rights are eroding in Florida, he thinks, so education is necessary to defend them. That legislation is yet to be heard in either chamber of the legislature. Still to come on Capitol Report, lawmakers are considering a measure that would help to clarify when insurance companies are acting in bad faith.
The reality is it's a significant problem. And if someone mentioned me, why would half of the trial bar in the state of Florida be here if they didn't think it was a problem?
As Florida lawmakers grapple with making a statewide wage theft protection program, some argue a bill doing just that is not needed.
The preemption of other counties being able to do this, but also because you're encouraging new counties, if they're going to address this problem, again, to use the most expensive possible way to do it.
Florida lawmakers are working to make the state's digital education dreams a reality, but how much will it cost?
Support for Capital Report is provided by The Able Trust, encouraging businesses to hire workers with disabilities. Information about the benefits of hiring people with a wide range of disabilities is available on the web at lookatmyability.org. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment.
For many years, tort or lawsuit reform has been a big goal of Florida's business community. This year, lawmakers are hoping a catch-all bill will give insurance companies more protection from frivolous so-called bad faith lawsuits and allow claimants to be paid more quickly at the same time. We get more on that story from Regan McCarthy.
Representative Kathleen Pasadimo says it feels like she's suffering from a case of deja vu. That's because the Naples Republican is bringing up the same bill for the third year in a row. And she's not the only one who's starting to feel like lawmakers are going in circles.
We were joking yesterday that maybe we should just play the tape from last year. But this is another thing that came up last year, and this is the issue of multiple claimants.
That's Miami Democratic Representative Jose Javier Rodriguez. Pasadimo's bill would cut down on the number of bad faith lawsuits insurance companies face. Those are lawsuits filed when the company fails to make an effort in good faith to settle a claim. Pasadimo says the process set out in her bill is simple.
This is how it's going to work. A loss occurs. An insured or a third party or even a third party's agent or attorney writes a letter to the insured's insurance company and advises them of the loss. The insurance company has a period of 45 days to investigate the claim and determine whether or not to make the offer.
If the insurance company offers the claimant the maximum amount outlined in the policy or any lesser amount the claimant is willing to accept, Pasadimo says that means the insurance company has acted in good faith. It's a plan, she says, will cut down on what she calls the gamesmanship in Florida, where claimants ask for too much or refuse to settle claims and then pursue bad faith actions. But others, including Rodriguez, have concerns with the measure.
They're not required to tender the an amount. They're simply required to offer something. Now, this is, in this area of law, there's obviously a lot of gotcha tactics, but this sets up the possibility that the following day they could withdraw that and still have complied with the letter of what the statute requires.
Pasadimo says she thinks any judge would see through that and mentioned she's willing to look for ways to clear that problem up in her bill. But Rodriguez isn't the only one who's raising concerns. Florida Justice Association President Paul Anderson says he's worried the companies could revoke their offers too. Anderson also worries 45 days is too short a time frame. He says that doesn't allow enough time for either the insurer or claimant to properly evaluate the claim.
The point being that if I'm representing the claimant to that coverage, I'm not going to be in a position to advise my client whether to accept or not to accept within 45 days of a notice of loss.
But others, including Fort Walton Beach Republican Representative Matt Gaetz, say it doesn't make sense to let the law continue as it is. The bill got Gaetz' attention, and he stopped into the Civil Justice Committee Wednesday, even though he's not a member of the panel. Gaetz says he thinks the measure will help to cut down on frivolous lawsuits and remit payments faster.
Because in the status quo, if you're the insured, the business, the citizen that's relying on your insurance company, there's no real bright line to know, you know, when they've acted in bad faith or when they haven't. And so there are circumstances that arise where perhaps the insurer drags their feet because there isn't this bright line.
Lawmakers passed the measure out of the committee with an 8-4 vote. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
A bill aimed at creating a uniform standard across the state to address residents' wage theft grievances passed its first House committee today. But as Sasha Cordner reports, it was met with much opposition.
Restaurants are one type of workplace commonly accused of wage theft. Tallahassee chef Ben Bennett says it happened to him at one of his former jobs.
I had a previous employer of mine who, took taxes out of my paychecks without ever having me fill out any tax paperwork for it, and then he gave me small little paycheck stubs that didn't show how much he was taking out or and any sort of My Social Anywhere or any information like that, and then he, at the end of the year, I never got any sort of tax information from him at all, and so essentially he was paying me and then he was taking out taxes and taking the taxes for himself.
He and several other employees wanted to pursue legal action, but a suit was never filed because too many employees feared they'd never work in the hospitality industry in the capital city again. Bennett says wage theft needs to be addressed, although he'd like the process to be more anonymous. It's an issue Florida lawmakers are spending their fourth consecutive year grappling with, and Polk City Republican Representative Neil Cumby is taking the helm this year.
The inspiration for this bill is, since we have 67 counties in Florida, there is, although not likely anytime soon, the chance for 67 different wage theft ordinances.
There are already local wage theft ordinances seeking to address residents' grievances against their employers' failure to pay them in Alachua, Broward, and Miami-Dade counties that would not be impacted by the bill. But Cumby says given the differences in those county ordinances, he doesn't want the rest of the state to have that kind of patchwork.
So when you are trying to conduct business in a number of counties, it would be helpful from an economic development standpoint, from a business standpoint, to have consistent application of the law. And you know, that's exactly what we're trying to do here.
So he modeled the bill after Palm Beach County's model. They don't have an actual ordinance, but the county did pass a resolution creating a program for wage theft claimants to be represented by the Legal Aid Society of Palm Beach County. County commissioners recently allocated $104,000 to continue the program, but AFL-CIO's political director Rich Templin says it's unfair for lawmakers to ask other counties to adopt such a program with such an expensive price tag when they're not even sure how successful it will be in other areas.
If you look at Miami-Dade, where they have created a small, simple, cheap administrative process that is working amazingly well, and you compare it to Palm Beach, which is spending over $100,000, and so far to a less result, this is putting an increased burden on taxpayers. This is telling local governments, hey, you can deal with this problem in your community, but we're going to make you spend as much money as humanly possible. Now, to hear that coming out of the Florida House is kind of surprising.
The Florida Retail Federation asked the legislature to address the issue. In 2011, they filed a suit questioning the constitutionality of Miami-Dade's ordinance, but a judge dismissed the case. The group's general counsel, Samantha Padgett, says while she prefers the language in past legislation, she believes creating a uniform standard based on Palm Beach's model is still a good idea.
Palm Beach worked with its business community and its local community activist organizations to develop a program that serves as model legislation for the bill you see before you. We applaud Palm Beach County for reviewing this issue and choosing not to adopt additional regulation, but instead to work with its local business community and legal aid society to adopt an approach that successfully addresses this issue.
Still, Florida Fraternal Order of Police President James Preston, representing about 20,000 law enforcement officers across the state, says he's opposed to the bill for several reasons. He doesn't believe the bill does enough to protect his fellow officers.
And as a result of being short-staffed or understaffed, many of them are required to work overtime. However, they're not paid for that overtime. They're forced to flex off or take comp time at the end of the week, which then requires other people to cover their shift, creating more overtime. And those people, in turn, will be off the next week, and it's just a snowball effect.
The House Civil Justice Subcommittee passed the bill 7-4 with Democrats opposed. Meanwhile, Cumbie and Altamont Springs Republican Senator David Simmons, the bill's Senate sponsor, are expected to hold a meeting with stakeholders soon to address their concerns. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kortner.
The head of the state agency that's been heavily criticized for troubles with Florida's unemployment assistance website faced little criticism during a Senate confirmation hearing today. Members of the Senate Budget Committee that oversees economic development unanimously voted to confirm Department of Economic Opportunity Director Jesse Panuccio. Panuccio was appointed to the post by Governor Scott in December of 2012. On his watch, the $63 million Connect computer system that replaced a 30-year-old system has been filled with glitches and delays in processing claims. But Panuccio told the committee Connect has turned the corner, in his words now. He credited that turnaround partly to adding 330 new employees to handle jobless claims at an estimated cost of $165,000 a week. Panuccio must still be confirmed by the full Senate, which bypassed the confirmation last year. You're listening to Capital Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Now here's Ronald J. Eben with a look ahead to tomorrow's action at the Florida Capitol.
The Senate Governmental Oversight and Accountability Committee meets at 9 Thursday morning to consider changes to the state retirement system, including increasing the employer contribution to the retiree health insurance subsidy. There's a controversial bill before the committee dealing with social media privacy. It would prohibit an employer from requesting or requiring access to a social media account of an employee or prospective employee. It would also prohibit an employer from taking retaliatory personnel action for an employee's failure to provide access to his or her social media account. Before a meeting of the Senate Appropriations Committee scheduled for 1 o'clock is a measure reducing motor vehicle license taxes, part of the governor's budget proposal. And Senator Jack Latvala's government ethics bill will also be heard. The Aaron Cohen Life Protection Act is also on the agenda. The bill requires the driver of a vehicle involved in a crash that results in serious bodily injury to remain at the crash scene. And failure to do so would be a second-degree felony, requiring the court to revoke your driver's license for at least 3 years. A telephone solicitation bill is also on the Appropriations Committee agenda, specifically prohibiting a telephone solicitor from transmitting text messages to a consumer who is on the no-sales call list. And the committee will vote on whether or not to create an agency of state technology. Those will be some of the bills before legislators on Thursday, March 13th. I'm Ronald J. Eben.
Finally tonight, Florida lawmakers want public education to go digital. In lawmakers' minds, schools would be places where students would work on their tablet computers and where teachers could reference textbooks and proctor tests online. But as Lynn Hatter reports, the digital reality is much different, and the cost associated with the transition is slowing progress.
State lawmakers want to turn Florida's public school classrooms into digital oases. To make sure it happens, they've set goals for increasing bandwidth and reducing regulations on textbook adoption to make room for other learning systems in the classes. But many school districts in Florida have a long way to go in realizing that digital dream.
First of all, getting set up as far as getting the digital devices is the first expense. Mm-hmm. And that's running about $400 a child at this point. And then finding digital content that we can use and keeping that up and maintaining.
Edie Triquet is the principal at Tallahassee's Bucklake Elementary School, where only a handful of the 50 or so classrooms have tablet computers. In those classes, the ratio of students per device is 2-1. The school, not the district, paid for most of the technology. And Triquet estimates in order to put tablets in all of her classrooms.
You're talking about $10,000 a classroom, roughly. And that's just to put a device in there. That's not teacher training. That's not making sure that there's an inactive board because the teacher has their device, but it needs to project so that the students can see what the teacher is seeing. So you're looking anywhere from 10 to about 18,000 a classroom.
Now, extrapolate that out to the rest of Leon County's 37 other schools. That number does not include charter schools or special sites like the district's alternative center. And it doesn't begin to cover lost or broken devices. And what happens when a parent isn't comfortable with how the devices are being used? That's a real concern for teachers like Alex Adams and Brian Howard.
They've been a little leery. And again, it's new. It depends on how much
exposure
they have.
I think the positives outweigh the negatives, though. I think they see some of that.
But despite all the administrative headaches, Adams and Howard say students love having portable computers in the classroom. For fourth graders Kate Karpinski, Lainey Whitaker, and Caitlin Carden, it's almost second nature and has made learning a lot more fun.
When Miss Adams, our teacher, said we were going to use technology, I was really, really excited.
One of the things we use is Edmodo. Now, this is actually a really interesting website because it's kind of like a little Facebook thing, but only for the students in a class and stuff.
My handwriting's not too well, and we write a lot of stories. But ever since we used this app called Storybird, I really like writing now.
Florida lawmakers are now looking at how to fund such programs. A bill by Senate Education Chairman John Legg would give school districts a minimum of $100,000 a year for digital education. But that may not be enough. A preliminary state estimate suggests Florida would have to spend nearly $70 million on basic infrastructure alone. Districts would also have to purchase supplies. And when all those costs are tallied, the state could easily be looking at a $1 billion price tag to make its digital dreams a reality. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Ronald J. Evan, Lynn Hatter, Stan Jastrzebski, Regan McCarthy, and Jessica Palumbo, along with Ryan Bank. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report, and join us again each weeknight during the 2014 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: a grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care, on the web at searcylaw.com. And from Tallahassee Regional Airport, offering service through American Airlines with daily direct flights from Tallahassee to Miami and Dallas-Fort Worth, with connections to over 270 domestic and international destinations. Fares and information available online at aa.com. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.